Amor con amor se paga. Or, love with love is paid. Or, love with love is paid. Or, eye for an eye. Or, no, no, I got this. Or, Fausti couldn't sleep without Cana's hand in his. He curled his body next to hers and reached out every night until she'd meet his hand. Then he slept. They woke up together, and they walked together too. Fausti picked fruit and put an arrow through a partridge's neck every so often, while Cana told him stories. She said, "That was back when Bachwe was still with us." Or, "That's why hummingbirds' necks are red." Or, "So they made her watch as they sliced her lover's ears, and then his nose, and then his penis, and then they made her eat his heart." And when Fausti would walk too far or lose himself in the track of some animals, Cana would whistle a five-note song so he could find his way back to her. One day, while they were walking, Cana stopped suddenly. She saw the sun setting, and she caught a glimpse of his golden hem. He was dressed entirely in gold, and everything around him glimmered, refulgent and beautiful, and Cana longed for it. "Just one piece," she thought, "one small piece in her hand to rub between her fingers while she watched Fausti climb a tree or make an arrow. That'd be enough." "Fausti," she said, "Fausti, how much I want some of the sun's gold, how much I can't even say." And Fausti took a deep breath, because he knew that to scrape even a flake, he would have to become one of the most formidable hunters in the land. So he tightened the straps around his shoulders, kissed her a long time, and set off to the east. When he left, Cana found she couldn't sleep without his hand in hers, and slowly she began to die. She stopped sleeping and started crying. She became faint and pale and sick with all the nights she was awake and he wasn't there. And then she wasn't there either. When Fausti finally came back, he found an empty house and an empty bed, and everywhere emptier than before. He walked out and yelled for her. He ran through the woods with a pouch full of gold hanging from his neck and yelling her name. He reached the town and yelled until someone finally led him to her grave. And then he got quiet. He curled up where her body lay buried, and he didn't move for 8 days, like a beetle's larva, dug up and drying in the sun. He sobbed and he cried all 8 days, until the elder god couldn't bear it anymore. "Fausti, Fausti," the elder god called out to him in a dream, "Fausti, listen to me." And Fausti listened. When he woke up, he rose from her grave, and, knowing what to do, he began to dig. He dug her up like the elder god had told him. He pulled her out, head and arms limp and bent softly back. He brushed the dirt from her eyes and hair and between her fingers. And then he began cutting. He took her leg and carved out skin and flesh, tendons and ligaments. He stuck his knife into her kneecap and then her hip socket. He pulled back and pushed forward and back and forward again until the bone was loose and he could rip out her femur. "Like this, Fausti," the god had said, "carved thin and hollowed out and makes holes down the spine here and here and here and here, and your fingers go here and here and here, and your lips go here." And when Fausti pressed the carved bone against his lips, covered the holes like the elder god had instructed, and blew into it, he heard Cana's voice again. De agua mansa me libre Dios, que de la brava me libro yo. Or, of water meek, myself liberate God, that of the angry one, myself liberate I. Or, God save me from peaceful currents, for I can save myself from strong ones. Or, God keep me from still waters. Or, they run deep. Or, the cacique loved his wife very much. He even told her so, often, in fact, at least in the beginning, how he'd seen her in a crowd of her kin and wanted her immediately, from marrow to skin, wanted her wholly and whole. He'd run a finger from her neck to her navel, slowly zigzagging between clavicles, breasts, and ribs, and he'd tell her about that day as if she hadn't been there, as if she didn't know there had been red terracotta snakes painted on her skin, cascading down the sides of her face, arching their backs against her cheekbones and braiding themselves into long geometric columns down her arms and legs, as if she didn't know the contour of her own face and breasts and hips. He'd run his fingers down on her skin as if he were explaining directions on a map from here to here and here to there. Turn at hip bone, pause at scar, straight down and in. And he'd tell her again and again how when he'd seen her eyes and heard her laugh, she'd made the snakes come to life. How, though no one else had seen it, not even her, he had. He'd seen her and seen them sliding down her thighs, around her ankles, and between her toes, across the dirt, and right into the cacique's bones. I saw you looking at me, and I felt them crawling up, and that was that. And he'd land his hand on her hip and push her against a wall, against the ground, against the sharp edge of a rock. He'd press his hand, and then his body, like the snakes, were clamoring inside him to come back to her, leap from him back into her, a terracotta tangle, snakes and flesh. And it wasn't bad. She put her hand over his and leaned back when he pushed. She untangled his hair and gently removed the gold breastplate, bracelets, and rings when he fell asleep drunk and crying on her lap. She blushed when he toasted her at his banquets, and she attended every banquet. One after the other, after the other, after the other, until one day he ran his finger down her sternum, down the valley where her ribs meet, and noticed a belly suddenly swelling. She wrapped her arms around taut belly skin and listened to him as he told her again how he'd wanted her first and last and immediately, how much still, how much forever. She'd listened while he drank and cried and fell asleep on her lap, saying, "All I've ever wanted, all and everything and nothing else, ever, ever, I promise." And then a child was born, a little girl like a hummingbird, so light when she was born, if he closed his eyes, he wasn't sure he was holding anything at all. And so fast when she became a girl, at times she seemed almost to be standing perfectly still. And that was enough for a while. A while and a half, until it wasn't anymore, and he arched his back and said, "A nice little banquet, I think, nothing too big." Nothing too big, then something slightly big, then something so big so often that the nights became one endless blur of music, fire, and faces. She tried to go once or twice, when their daughter was still very little and needed to be held, but these things are loud and bright, and she had to leave before things even really got started. If she'd tried again, perhaps she might have noticed the cacique slipping out with one or two women every so often. Maybe she'd have caught his eye as he came back, dusting his shoulders and pulling sticky seeds from his hair. But she didn't need to see him slipping out. It was enough that he never came back to her at night, or even for days and weeks, a month once, at least. By the time she could rejoin the cacique's elaborate banquets, he didn't so much as go through the theatricalities of guilt. no effort put into slinking or whispering, no telling this girl or that woman to wait by that tree or this wall, nothing. 5 times, the cacique's wife made note, he'd outright tossed a woman like a fresh deer carcass over his shoulder and carried her out. And once, he'd completely covered his body in gold dust and made the particularly beautiful wife of a nobleman lick him clean before all in attendance, after which he'd taken the habit of carrying a pouch of gold dust around his neck, just in case. He came and went from banquet to bed. He stumbled home only ever accidentally, and he did not see his wife drawing red terracotta snakes in more and more elaborate knots and braids down her arms and legs and between her toes, and he did not see the shaved-head Guecho warrior seeing what he didn't. That's where the story begins, seeing, not seeing, and forgetting having ever seen at all. That's where it begins and ends. Because after being seen so intensely for so long, the cacique's wife couldn't go without it, and she had to meet her lover often. She had to run her fingers down his chest, tell him about the night they'd met, and bite the tip of his fingers to watch him drown a scream in his throat for fear of being discovered. It's not the same for men and women. The burden is different, and the cacique cannot allow certain things to be whispered or rumored. He must take note and precautions. He must invite his wife to one more banquet and make himself perfectly clear. There is no other way around it. He must be clear publicly about present and future things, so that everyone understands that she must be made to understand. That even though it may be hard for her to see right then, she must come to see that he has no choice but to serve her, her lover's penis, on a plate, before bringing out what's left of the warrior tied to a pole, a grunting, dripping mess of blind flesh, spitting chunks of a ripped-out tongue before a priest finishes the deed by ripping out his heart and setting it next to his penis on the plate. The true culprits, side by side, on a plate of gold, before the casita of Guatavita. And she must be made to eat them, to set things right, and put them away, where no one can see. The cacique's wife could neither turn from the sight nor keep her stomach from turning. She fell to the ground shaking and weeping and vomiting, while the braver part of the court congratulated the cacique and pretended away their repulsion, though it took everything in them to do so. The sight and smell were so overpowering, most didn't notice the cacique's wife running and pushing her way out of the crowd. By the time they noticed she was holding her sleeping daughter tightly and running through the fog like she'd practiced the route in her mind 1,000,000 times. This is how most things begin. An inconsolable woman holds her child and runs into a lake. The water was cold, and the little girl woke up. The fog was thick, and her mother was crying, so she didn't say a word. She remained limp but wide-eyed in her mother's arms, staring back at her father while he yelled for the cacique to come back to shore, to leave his daughter, to come back, to not take the child at least. Please, please. But the cacique's wife did not turn back. Not when her husband begged, not when the cacique commanded, not even when he sent his holiest priests and mohanes in after her. She was gone. They told him no way around it. The holiest mohan even swam all the way to the bottom and came back. Dripping in his white robes, he told the cacique, she sits in a throne in the midst of live wreaths of blue and green snakes. She won't come back now. Not now. But the cacique couldn't bear it. He kept begging and pleading and screaming to bring her back, at least his little hummingbird child, who drummed her fingers on his cheeks like beating wings to wake him up. So the Mohan stood up again and, shaking his head, went back into the water. With nothing left to do, the cacique sat perfectly still by the lake, not crying, not sleeping, not blinking at all. He stared at the water, at his breath condensing in the air and the little flat stones his wife had overturned on her final sprint. He sat, cross-legged, and stared, paralyzed by a sudden hyper-awareness of himself, the dimensions of his feet, the length of his hair, the beating of his heart. "Oh, heart, the heart," he heard himself say before he could really form the words in his mind. Then it was the weight of his head, the width of his fingers and the coiling of his intestines, the noises of a thing alive, ticking, pumping, rushing, blinking, growing, stirring, and curdling. He saw himself seeing himself, heard himself hearing, a heartbeat beating in concentric echoes, a man noticing himself, noticing his noticing, and he felt with distinct acuteness the half-digested banquet meat climbing up his esophagus, splashing against his teeth and foaming out to the sides of his mouth. Still paralyzed, he vomited on his own lap and let the rest drip down his chin. He sat and waited, hearing and seeing himself hearing and seeing everything around him until he was sick and dizzy and twice as paralyzed as before. Then the Mohan emerged with a shivering child in his arms. "A little dragon," the Mohan began to say, and the cacique tried to lift himself from the ground. "See, you have to close your eyes," he started again. "When you swim to the water realm," and again the cacique tried to move, but nothing budged. His eyes darted back and forth, like children trying to tip a boat, but nothing, nothing. "You have to. We all know that. But how could she?" The Mohan seemed too distracted to notice the cacique's struggle and simply brought him the child so he could see the empty sockets where something had nibbled away her eyes. "Little dragons do it. I felt them before." Now the cacique heard nothing, felt nothing, saw nothing but his daughter's face. "They've little mouths and rows of frail teeth and can't get a good bite of anything harder than an eyeball." The hyper-awareness, having completely devoured and choked on itself, left little behind. "That's why you have to, always." But she wouldn't have known that. Only the world through a pinprick hole. And on the other side, a little girl, pink water pooling inside empty sockets, and the realization of all that had come before this moment to make it this specific moment and no other. Then the cacique was finally able to move. He held the little girl's hand. Little bones, wet skin, soft tips. He brushed her hair back, dipped his finger into the gold dust pouch, and drawing snakes on her face, told the Mohan to take her back to her mother and take care to close his eyes on the way down.
I am Kathleen Gilbert, reading my translation from Ovid's Heroides, Penelope to Ulysses. "This your Penelope sends to you, slow Ulysses. Don't write back. Come yourself. Troy is certainly defeated by now, hated by the Greek girls. Priam and all of Troy were hardly worth it. I wish that, when his fleet was asked for in Sparta, raging waters would have overwhelmed the adulterer. I don't deserve to lie on a frigid bed, nor to complain that the days go by so slowly. Nor should I be seeking answers in the space of nightfall, my hands weary from widow's weaving. When was I not afraid of grave risks? The thing is, love is full of frightening terror. I imagined you in violent Trojan battles. The name Hector always made me turn pale. When I heard Antilochus was a victim of the enemy, I was full of anxiety.
Kent Latham, a translation from Hugh Barclay's Scots language sonnet to Alexander Montgomery. My best beloved brother of the craft, God, if you only knew the state I'm in. Though you're stone deaf, I know you are not daft, but kind enough to any of your kin. Oh, if you could see me in this winter wind with tattered leggings, jumping on a spade, draggled in dirt, wet through to the skin, I know you'd join me in weeping up a flood. But most of all, my misery's been fed to hear how you, on your side of the moor, frolic with wine and blithely go to bed, forgetting me, poor ploughman, I'm sure. So, silly me, oppressed with dreams of beers, envy you your leisure, pulling Bacchus's ears. Kent Latham, from A Poetic History of 1975 to 1996. Of our national consciousness, we have no aptitude of sugar, God rewards. Of Wichita in the distance of this cloth doll, witch of Champlain. Of Mercury, its zero, ice, soon. Of memory and changing form, of whom I remember nothing more of day, the drying wrinkled shirts of the casing of a shimmering green-gold dragon. Of all storms, striking your Irish cliffs of Moher, of his mother, how she died in the fall of artillery, I never thought it would sing of greenery, as the last pale crumbs of mangosteens, for which we'd both fallen, of heaped-up bedding, stroked slantwise by fingers of afternoon sun. Macintosh, he said again, of Poynton, so slowly the plot seemed unfold of rice cakes, and an apple, in a garden of light and wind, of an exhausted star, told me nothing. Of mountains. Here, the floors of crickets that are fed fish of a baby's rattle, moves in of the children, at night, of men full of beer who now of grown-up children's rooms and hallways wear of tortured grammars writhing on their stakes, of statues in their hands, while numberless of the spillway. Trees surfacing of my parents' cellar, I rummage, looking of an afternoon they were left, her doorway with its of exile, of school, of being sent to bed, of being.
The Hidden Town. 1. H had just purchased a truck with his brothers, which he was going to use to haul materials to the construction site of a highway that would cross through our town. The truck was so large it could not fit onto our narrow roads. He had to park it outside the entrance to our town. His two brothers took turns sleeping in it to make sure nothing happened to the truck. One of the brothers sat with us for dinner, eating silently and fanning the flies. We threw leftovers into the dog dish. Afterward, we watched television in the dark to avoid attracting the mosquitoes. There was a live update of the Russians huddled around a small hole somewhere in the middle of the South Pole. They were trying to get a sample of the water from an undisturbed lake under 2 miles of ice. They'd drilled to where they almost touched the surface. The reporter spoke about a feared geysering effect from pressure change, the old water spewing up and out. The screen was bright from all the footage of snow, so white it was as if the room were lit. 2. The teacher stood before her students, explaining the layers of the earth. She had even brought a miniature model to show them. It was like the model of skin at the doctor's office. Mid-sentence, she felt a pop and an unbuckling of her chest. Folding her arms, she excused herself and allowed the students to take out the class pet, a small, muzzled snake. In the bathroom, she turned off the light, and in a stall sized for children, she twisted her arms behind and beneath her flowery blouse and struggled to refasten her unmentionable. A young girl walked by the doorway and peered at the teacher standing in the darkness. She studied the teacher's face, an expression she never forgot. 3. I walked regularly in the mornings, just before 7. Sometimes I came across people I knew. When M jogged toward me with her dog to say hello, the dog darted in the opposite direction upon seeing me. As we spoke about our weeks, I continued to think about why the dog had darted away from me. There really was no reason. I knew that M had seen it too, and I wondered if M was concerned about the dog darting, and by extension, my dog-sitting methods. In the dog's defense, I had wanted to dart too when I saw M and her dog, but I hadn't. M could be intimidating with her clean mannerisms and conversational ease, and I had indeed darted on previous walks through the town square, hiding behind a bush or tree to avoid contact. I didn't understand what I had done to the dog, whom I've often allowed to nest in my lap as I read, even though it always left behind a ring of fur. I sensed my own indignation. I had expended so much energy to suppress my need to bolt that the dog should have at least faked some enthusiasm. 4. She woke up with his foot in her hand. She supposed it was true that a fight could be healthy and was what was needed to move forward. She drove away from his little house, past the French-American school and florist, to her own house on a parallel street. As she turned the corner, she noticed two small boys playing in the front yard of the neighboring house. Two more boys, a little taller, emerged from behind the gate that opened to the backyard. She drove slowly past the gate and found more similarly sized boys standing behind the fence. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 boys. As she counted, she did not notice her car drifting into the next lane until she sideswiped a parked van. Now all of the boys were looking at her, and she was once again unsure of what to do. 5. The bus trip wore down our nerves. We had wanted to see the petrified forest, which was 9 million years old. A woman with a tight ponytail and her chubby husband with a looser ponytail fussed about no seats being available in the front and made the entire bus sit according to the seat number assigned on our tickets. Our two seats were in the very back, by the wheel. Just after we gave up our seat, the bus driver stepped back onto the bus and told the passengers that the bus was first come, first serve, and would not be checking seat numbers. At the back of the bus, we sighed. All along the road, the peach trees bore fruit into paper bags. Boy, you ran onto a bridge under construction, little fish paths beneath your feet, small enough to put your finger over. What a giant you were. You turned toward a love. You were always before him. You spent your entire boyhood running ahead. Dad, the bridge changed? A curl into a question like a cattail. The brush against. The oomph in your vernacular. It had changed. A version closer to a perfected system of connection or suspension. A difference you bit into and held as all your teeth erupted. Jaw surgery made your speech different. Your chin emerged from behind a door. You're fishing into mud water. You don't let your teeth yellow. When you dream of missing teeth, you know what it means. Dying, not your own, never that, but of destinations and harbors, of things that exceed you, of the time machine on your father's shoulders, arched over fish, scaling. The scrape of his wristwatch against stone. He's getting close to the end of his fish. He's got you turning tripe. You want access beyond the mudrick walls of words. You want an opening in the shape of your figure everywhere.
This is Erica Brown reading Captain Snugs Rides Again, Again. Break a brandy snifter. Break any small thing. A nugget of bituminous coal. Not a heart. Not a lot. Afterwards, improve yourself. Refrain from hitting snooze. Fix a small thing. A bug or a capillary. Eat a schnitzel with capers. Stop taking orders. Adopt a schnauzer. Adopt a funny German accent when commanding it to stay. Captain Snugs, how is your mouth always so hot? I love you more every day, not less, and this concerns me. You mug. Plus, we live on a floodplain. It may all seem non-germane, but God, sometimes it's cloudy, sometimes luminous. This is Erica Brown reading Dirty Birdies. For my rabbity heart, nervous in the birches, I enrolled in a class for those with pain or injury, but it wasn't what I expected. A whiffle of light still flickers by the wharf. Once I was adopted by a family of line dancers. When you fall in love, then you are just down someplace. Consider welding to unite by heat or compression. After softening, consider the silliness of yon weft without a warp. What a weave we make. Whether you are a castrated ram, whelp, you are a young pup. Whether introduces an alternative clause followed by another alternative or not. Cave paintings existed during the first ice age. Your problems are not new, although yes, it is cold in here. Oh, counterfeit wampum, I saw the sign and it said, varicose veins demand excellence. What are your demands? Consider how she whimpers when you unpeel the sheet music. Whoop, there it is. The foam-crested waves are also known as white horses. Don't mind the noise. It's just birds loosing into the night. This is Erica Brown reading The President. The President demands all your golden paper clips. The President demands your nights, which is fine because she's the President. The President already has your hay-sown days. You give the President your children, one after another. The President has established connection with your umbilical cord, which she tugs at random, sending you careening back to the President. You have come all this way for the President. The President is a lady of many stipulations. You steal a few quiet moments with her creamy cardstock. You know that in the basement, your hay fever has much abated. Thanks to you, the President, the chiggers and the sand fleas are hardly a problem. The President builds monuments to her nuclear family, and you write the memorandums. Morals don't come into this, your mouth stuffed with morels. The President is a busy woman. You realize you are being watched. You are being watched.
Whitney Houston's Greatest Love Mix. Whitney Houston, why did you have to marry, die? More cracked lesbian rumors threading on Yahoo. Day before Grammys drowning in Beverly Hills. Bathtub of bankruptcy, booze, and pills as if not enough shit. Hollywood, in the world, another tragic diva, New Jersey native. Gone, another reality rerun to entertain ennui. Outrage at seeing you, our Whitney, leave full blast without a farewell lamb lambast from Republican tea, pat on the shoulder time, or diehards dykes, blaming, shouting, boo, Bobby drugs, as the time I sat, nosebleed seat, God inside Aloha Stadium flea market and listen while you lose. Pray for a voice to stay throughout. I will always love you. Who could forget, forgive? Then hubby was front act, cover up, some say, to appease, please, Jesus, as two freshman girls from another memory dance, touch to all the man that I need. She, he fills me up, she, he gives me love, who cares, you're gone now, embraceable more, so irreplaceable, Aretha, Lena in one, as one musician critic said, blossoming alongside Reagan, Boy George, and my very first deep kiss from a geek, hot, how will I ever forget? Thank you, in slinky dress, gray, matching long, tight-fitting arm, warmers, pink, frosty lips, MTV's biggest bow on your head, singing, dancing to the very top of the world chart. How will I know, knowing, learning what I already knew right then or thought I did about love, losing during a brief moment, eternity in one's life. Last dance. So sad, begins Justin's brief note. Donna Summer passed away this morning, followed by ellipsis. What else is there to say other than I'm here, standing by the window, processing recovered memories in lieu of loss, morning sun on my face, ghetto and glamour 22 stories beneath my feet. It makes me sad and sick to say farewell to another diva whose disco tracks made my first years in America supra bearable. Donna was my lay greeter, darling. I did not only assimilate or, anthropologically speaking, acculturate. I flipped my feathered hair, flaunted my fresh off-the-plane attitude in familiari platforms, polyester long-sleeved shirts, denim bell-bottoms. I oohed and awed 22 times, baby, throughout Love to Love You, baby. On the dance floor, rolled my eyes back to Avila, while imaginary lovers guided me out of fear and longing for a home no longer there. Disco and Donna had taken over as my new world. I felt safe and sexy and was myself. When I wasn't imagining grooving with my secret crush to dim all the lights, my hands on his waist, his hands on my shoulders, enough distance between us to watch the biting of our lips and whisper to each other the most beautiful word in the disco language, babe. Then there was that afternoon in 79, Jeff choreographed a bad girl's number to be performed on a stone wall by me, Julie, my sister Jing, as three die-hard hookers on Hotel Street selling love at half off because it was cheaper than sorry. How we dance and role-play deep into the night. Oh, we went on worshiping you, Donna. Even after word got around that disco caused cancer and you turned your back on Adam and Steve and Eve. Your number one fans of fags and hags. We saluted you then as I and the sun bow to you now, hearing your voice in my head again singing, could it be magic? After all these years, what else could it be but magic and arias and endless oohs and ahs of almost gone glory? Here's to your first day of everness, dearly Donna, patron diva of our unending last dance. Ars Poetica. It's already 4:30, and Bukowski's whores and liquor store poets are far from those pre-twilight frustrations and bedroom boredom that once led to grandstanding and gratuitous verses with internal rhymes as bonuses. Till this day, they stick to my mother's memory like smegma stuck between dilemma and Pab's pubic lice. Always nice on jasmine rice. Or is there hope stronger than a rope for our Pope? Making art always begins with sweet scent of F, said Plato. Or was it Pluto in a couplet? Hairpiece best covers herpes and haikus. red lipstick on front tooth, slightly chipped 70-year-old Lolitas, explosive and exhausted titles of B lyrical odes, gospel according to Luke Loser, and who won the war between Gentile and genital warts, alliterations enough for everyone. Even the window washer feels sorry, working overtime, scrubbing grime and bacon grease off my studio window so I can see beyond the bald voyeur across my building, scratching to sniff his dangling balls as he watches me scrape white meat off an Oreo. Cliché, I wish it came from the passing cloud of cellulites, a cue to end the sun salutation and throw in the dash.
My name's Casey Plett, and I'm reading a story called Me and You. You were always very sweet. I was waiting for my dad on the top of the stairs of the third floor, scratching at the peeling wallpaper, and you came up to me and said, "Don't do that, you'll get icky." You tried to put the wallpaper back and got mad when you couldn't. You beat on the wall with your hands. You turned to me and your eyes were wet, and you said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't put it back. Are you mad at me?" I said, "No, I said, I don't want to be mad. You're nice." You beamed and sat down beside me on the stairs. You said, "Hi." I said, "Hi." You said, "My name is Brittany. Do you have a name?" I told you my dad called me George, and you laughed and said, "George, George, George, George." Your mom came around, and you said, "Mommy, I have a friend. Look, his dad calls him George. What does my dad call me?" She smiled at me, but it didn't look real. She said to you, "That's very nice. We have to go, okay? We're in a hurry." You moved to her coat. You didn't look happy. "You can play with George later." You disappeared down the stairs, waving back to me before she pulled you all the way gone. When my dad finally came, I said, "Dad, I met a friend here. Her name's Brittany. Does she live here? Do you know any Brittanys?" He said he didn't, but we would have to look out for her later sometime. I asked if he thought we would find her, and he said, "Yes, we will, but later." We went down the stairs, out of the building, around the pile of dirty snow, to the bus stop, on the bus, and over to daycare. And the whole time I looked for you because I thought maybe if I looked hard enough, you would be standing on the sidewalk or around the corner. You were by the mailboxes with your mom when I saw you next week. You were wearing a green hat. I squealed when I saw you and I said, "Brittany, Brittany!" You ran up to me and said you were happy I was there because you'd forgotten what my face looked like. I pointed to my head and said, "It looks like this. Will you remember next time?" You said, "Yes." This time your mom watched us. Then she bent down and said things into your ear. Your eyes got so big. You said to me, "Where do you live? Because I live in 305. Can I know where you live, please?" And I told you 302, and you said, "Okay." My dad made me knock on your door the next day. Your mom opened the door a little and smiled when she saw me. I liked it this time. She said hello and took off the chain and opened the door big. My dad pushed my shoulder and I asked if Brittany was home. She said yes. She told us to come in, and my dad started talking with her. You were in the living room playing, and you looked happy when you saw me. You were showing me your Legos when I heard a big banging from the couch. I got scared and yelled. You said, "No, it's just the radiator. Mom says ours is broken, but it can't hurt us." "Oh," I said, "okay." The banging kept coming, and I thought I'd cry some because the noise was so loud and everywhere. But then you said, "Here, look, watch, I'll be safe." You lay down next to the couch and pushed yourself under it. I thought you were gone for sure, but then you said, "See, I'm all safe, and guess what? I'm going to show you something nifty, but you have to be here to see it." I was scared, but I knew if you were in trouble, then I had to help, and so I had to come no matter what. I lay down and pushed myself under the couch. It was dark next to you, really, really dark, because the couch had flaps that covered it to the floor. The radiator banged, and I almost made a yell, but you said, "Shh, guess what?" And I said, "What?" And you said, "Look up. It's like we're in space." I looked and didn't yell, and even though all I could see was really dark, it was like the dark was twisting. I thought I saw colors, like dots of them. There was purple and green and blue. A few hours later, back in our apartment, I wanted to show my dad what you showed me. He was in his room. Or maybe he wasn't? Sometimes he went out and didn't tell me where he went. But I went up to his door, and there was music coming out. Loud music. I knocked on the door and said, "Dad?" But I just heard music. I thought maybe he'd gone and forgotten about it, but then I heard him say, "Go to sleep." And then the music got louder. "Dad," I said again. The music stopped. "Go to sleep," he said. And the music started again, and I ran into the living room, and I tried lying under the couch, but I couldn't fit. Ours was lower. Instead, I got stuck. I wiggled it up. My sides were hooked in under the couch, and it hurt. And I said, "Dad, Dad," and he didn't come. And then after a while, I started screaming, like, "Help, I'm stuck, Dad." I screamed and I started crying too, and I waved my arms and wiggled my sides and kept screaming and screaming, but nothing happened. I did that for a long time. Then I let my legs go still, and I felt the cool of the floor on my skin. And I did that, and I remembered your face. I remembered your face. I lay there quiet until after a while my dad came out of his room, naked and muttering and with his eyes going crazy. You knocked on my door to tell me you were going away. My dad let you in even though your mom wasn't there. You said your mom didn't tell you why, but that she yelled at you when she didn't ever, and she was renting a van tomorrow, and she looked really sad. I said, that means we won't ever see each other ever again, and you curled your fingers on the top of your hands, and your eyes scrunched, and you said, we won't, it's stupid, it's really, really, really stupid. My dad was listening. He felt bad. He got out a camera and told us to smile, and took dozens of pictures of me and you. He gave you the film when he was done and told you to develop it someday. I cried, because you had something to remember me by and I didn't. So you took off your shoes, and then your socks. And they were black. You smiled and said, here, these are for you. We moved soon to a little later. I thought about us and your socks again, and if your mom asked, where'd they go? My name's Casey Plett, and I'm reading a story called Gas. The first girl slides off her shoes and puts her feet on the floor of the car. Empty bags of chips are on the mat. She grabs at a couple and drops them in the back. The second girl, driving, doesn't take her eyes off the road, curving around walls of forest. She said we should clean this the next time we stop. The first girl says, "Kay," and reclines her seat back. The second girl sighs and rests her hand on the first girl's thigh. The first girl squeezes the second girl's hand. She says goodnight. She tilts herself toward the door. The car stops at an Arco station. The first girl stirs and says, where are we? Shelton. Where's that? Hour from Coeur d'Alene. We need to clean the car. I'm sleeping. The first girl sits up. Past the overhead station lights, she can make out husky, scattershot silhouettes of low-rise buildings. We shouldn't be here, she says. We need gas and the car's filthy, says the second girl. She takes her long, stocky frame out of the car. Oh, we'd make it, says the first girl, aggravated. The gauge is fucked and I don't want... The car's filthy, says the second girl. Since you're up, you want to fill the tank? Thanks. She shuts the door and lopes toward the store, and the first girl fixates on the point of the second girl's Adam's apple serenely obtruding the store's light as she pulls open a glass door. A boy sits behind a counter on a fluorescent orange stool, playing with one of the Zippos. He yawns and glugs from a tall cup of cool coffee. A man with a gray coat on the other end of the store is by the fountain drinks, filling a cup with mellow yellow. The second girl enters and the boy looks up. She smiles and moves to the stacks. The boy watches her. The first girl likes cashews, and the second girl takes two packages. They are out of Clorox wipes and Advil, and the second girl takes those as well. The second girl considers coffee before settling on soda and passes the man in the gray coat. He accidentally bumps her, and he doesn't spill his soda, but one of the cashew packages slips out of the second girl's hand. He bends down and says pardon, and she nods, takes the cashews back, and squeaks a thanks. The man scans her body as he rises. He takes in her legs, her boobs, her jaw, her eyes. He pauses and looks at her level and hard, his facial expression blank, but the second girl tries very hard to do the same. Then he smiles, tips his mariner's cap, and heads for the counter. The boy puts down the Zippo and beeps in the man's purchase. The second girl fills up a cup with mellow yellow. The first girl fuels up, cleans the car. She throws away empty bags of chips and cashews. She throws away soda and coffee cups, fast food receipts. She takes books cluttered on the back floor mats, drops them into bags in the trunk. She wonders if she can't find the Clorox wipes or if they're actually out. She looks through the store windows, sees the wipes nestled under the second girl's armpit. The first girl smiles and sees the boy and the man with the gray coat. She freezes for a second, then grabs the car keys, shuts the door, locks it, and walks inside. The keys jingle in the pocket of her hoodie, unzipped, banging against her jeans. The man is showing the boy a book, and the second girl is deliberating on chips when the first girl comes inside. All three look up at the first girl. The second girl's face pulls back in a bun of fear. The boy stares at the first girl, and the man looks from the first girl to the second girl to the first girl. The second girl raises the yellow cylinder and says, "Got the wipes!" First girl says thanks. The man clears his throat, puts a hand in his pocket, and begins walking toward the second girl. The boy begins walking toward the first girl. The second girl, rabbit-eyed, resolutely fixed to the floor, only moves once the man is a few feet away. She runs to an emergency exit door and shoulders it open. The first girl runs out and starts the car. The man and the boy look at each other. One shrugs and the other shakes his head and takes a slurp from his drink.
The Garbage Men's Strike by Jean Ferry. Since no one knew what to do with the trash while the garbage men were on strike, we burned it in the little central heating boiler. But the ashes wouldn't burn, and soon we didn't know where to put them. I was very tired back then, even more tired than usual, and I couldn't call up the energy to haul the ashes that were piling all the way to the heap at the intersection, whose growth the neighborhood concierges surveyed, not without some pride. I dumped the ashes between the boiler and the little nook, and soon there were a lot, because to make the garbage burn, I was also burning my ration of coal nuts. Now, a bad precedent, worse habits, the fire going out one day. In short, we soon wound up throwing out things that weren't ashes, things we'd have been better off burning. In a little apartment like ours, a heap of trash like that was really unpleasant, all the more so because it began to slide, to spread here, there, and everywhere, and there was no end to sweeping in that dim little room where the boiler was. We threw everything on that ash pile, oyster shells, banana peels, an empty can, fabric scraps. It was a regular landfill. But I was so tired. So naturally, what had to happen, happened. One morning, where the pile had been, was an old beggar who reproachfully watched me cross the room, probably because I wasn't giving him anything. He'd put so much care taking shape from our trash that apart from him, everything was now clean and orderly in that little room. Scrutinizing him with despair, I found the ashes in the filth of his grayish cast, from the banana peels he'd made pallid fingers shapeless and trembling, from white eggshells the whites of his eyes, and from fabric scraps the tatters that clothed him. And toward me he extended the tin can which had seemed useful for begging. He fit precisely into that little recess, and with a heavy heart, I knew right away that there was no getting him out of there now. The next day the strike was over, the garbage trucks rolling merrily down every street. But my panhandler's still there. I don't know what to do. We always have to go through that little room to get to the other half of our apartment, anyway. We really had to light the fire again, and where he is, he can't possibly be cold. He never speaks, barely even moves, but each time we pass by, he holds out the tin can with a trembling arm, and despite every thought I can muster against charity, I go back to the kitchen for some change, if I'm not carrying any. No one dares walk by him now without giving him something. The concierge says, "Just bring him down with the other trash. Once he's in the can, you won't be able to tell him from everything else." Easier said than done. I don't have a big enough shovel, and he looks so cozy over there by the boiler. Maybe he'll leave when the fire goes out. The cats are lucky indeed. They don't see him, they don't even know he's there, and they sleep right where he does. Like we didn't have enough troubles already. A Tear in His Eye by Jean Ferry. Who among us, at that age when we grow curious about fantastical tales, hasn't been captivated by the story of that character who describes himself as endowed by the Creator with the face of a hyena, lips of bronze, eyes of jasper, and a reproductive organ much closer to the deadly viper than a harmless phallus? Among other peculiarities of a personality that seems to have been difficult, this individual, mired throughout his brief unhappy life in what he calls, quote, "the green membranes of space," we credit the expression entirely to him, insists on having it known that it was impossible for him to laugh. I won't mention here the curious experiment that followed this confession, whose principal accessory was a well-sharpened razor. What I want to write about today is an absolutely analogous case, by which I mean the total opposite. It has to do with a very dear friend, whom I'll call Jean for simplicity's sake, and who could never manage to cry. I found this case even stranger than that of the aforementioned polymorphous hero, as it is clear that occasions for tears are, all things considered, more common than occasions for laughter. And yet, up to the age of 42, no matter how much he wanted to, Jean had never yet managed to extract from his lacrimal glands a single drop of what some call the heart's dew, and others, much closer to the truth, call a liquid composed of mucus, water, salt, and phosphate of lime. Like all his fellow creatures, he had met with excellent reasons to weep. He had lost his childhood. During that childhood, he'd met with many a disappointment. As a teenager, he'd suffered unjustly, but is any suffering just? He had, as was expected, bid loved ones goodbye and seen those he hated and despised triumph. He'd even known sweet ecstasies, those vague and generous impulses that, urged on by moonlight or a view of the sea, bring a slight mistiness to even the driest eyes. But not a drop. Doctors, consulted one after the other, could only remark upon the absolutely normal physical state of a patient who bore a pair of lacrimal glands in excellent condition. Now, this man, whom nature refused our common consolation, When death came for the woman he loved most of all, when his best friend betrayed and ruined him, when he saw the most melancholy tragedies play out before him, when, in the depths of discomfort, he was forced one winter morning to pull back over numb feet the holy socks he'd washed secretly in cold water the night before in the shared hotel sink, socks that were far from dry, and few are those who in such circumstances haven't shed a few tears over their fate. This man whom a sudden, unexpected luck filled with colossal contempt for cowardly sycophants, for they made him lose all confidence in human goodness, a loss which anyone might have underscored with a tear. This man who honestly, sincerely tried all his life to cry at every suitable moment without ever succeeding, this poor man, one autumn eve, burst into tears. We know why, and the investigation revealed that a grocer he'd begged for a few ounces of salt, with such courtesy as might have seemed quaint. A grocer whose shop he'd confidently entered, whom he'd approached with kindly sympathy, ready at the slightest sign to grant him his brotherly love, had answered him with the ignoblest brutality, "There's no more salt." The man who'd never been able to cry went home, profoundly affected, and began to cry. He wept for an hour over events in their reverse order, over the grocer's meanness, over the infamy of the human race, over Gustave's treachery, over the death of a woman he'd loved, over the death of Uncle Tom, over the death of the Lady of the Camellias, over his wet socks, over the shitters he'd cleaned when it wasn't his turn for chores, over being last in geography class, over his first tooth. He wept for an hour, then another, and as he fell asleep he was crying still. In the morning his grief had calmed somewhat, but he noticed that he'd cried during his sleep and his pillow had to be wrung out. He wrung it out, weeping, and only toward evening on that second day did he seriously start worrying. He'd gotten over his whole life, but he was still crying. And it was very wearisome. After a night of tears and anguish, he went to find a doctor who prescribed rest, just in case. Jean locked himself in his room and, for many long days, let flow his monotonous and regular tears. Falling on the table, they gradually warped the wood. Jean lost weight, grew pale in his solitude, and in the eyes of the medical faculty, bent in astonishment over this unique and monstrous phenomenon, it became clear that he would soon melt entirely away, a possibility all the more distressing since Jean had recovered, as they say, his taste for life, and now enjoyed himself at the drop of a hat, and laughed so hard that he cried when reading funny books. But the grocer, on accidentally hearing that he was the cause of this event swelling column inches of newsprint, was seized with remorse. Not daring to present himself before his victim, he sent by post, with apologies, a bag of particularly refined salt. A paper cone of it came with the morning mail at 8. On entering Jean's room at 9 a.m., the cleaning lady recoiled with horror and fainted, dropping the buckets and sponges she used so many of daily. The head, limbs, and innards of my unlucky friend were strewn around the room's four corners, amidst splatters and objects better left unspecified. From his right hand, the grocer's unfolded letter was pried with difficulty. Reading it had doubtless moved him so violently that he'd exploded in sobs.